Jewish party would fall in Russian hands. He was told that it has been established that they were working on behalf of Germany. When he protested the absurdity of Jews from Poland working on behalf of Hitler, his protests were met with a shrug. And yet Trotsky turned out to be a German agent. Jews were arrested en masse and put on trial in the Soviet Union and Soviet-dominated countries. And then those same trials were used as proof of a Jewish conspiracy. In 1948, the Soviet Union became the first country to recognize the newly declared state of Israel, expecting Israel to be a bulwark against the West due to violent conflict between the Israelis and the British rulers. Months later, Stalin saw this would not be the case and refused to allow Soviet Jews to emigrate. Future Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir was Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union, visiting Moscow in September of 1948. When tens of thousands of Russian Jews came out to welcome her, Stalin ordered the arrest of any one of them who could be identified from photographs of the event. During World War II, a Soviet organization called the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee was created to mobilize world opinion to help the USSR fight against Hitler. After the war, any Soviet Jew who wrote to them inquiring about Israel, a land where Jews would be safe from persecution, was arrested. Stalin's campaign against the USSR's Jewish population came with the same tortures and farcical accusations as had taken place in the Great Terror. Jewish intellectuals and writers began to be systematically driven from their jobs as traitors, and many of them were arrested too. Lena Stern was the USSR's most prominent female scientist, a so-called Einstein in skirts, whose discoveries regarding the blood-brain barrier still hold up decades later. That didn't save the 71-year-old woman from arrest. Her interrogators called her an old whore and claimed that when she was at conferences abroad, she had sold her body. At my age, I would be the one paying, she snapped. While many of her co-defendants were shot, she managed to receive the lighter sentence of deportation to Kazakhstan. Stern's Jewish gallows humor was one of the few mechanisms available to deal with the increasing newfound oppression, as another anecdote revealed. The phone rings. Please, may I speak with Abramovich? He's not at home. Is he at work? No. Is he out of town? No. Did I understand you right? Yes. Throughout his life, Stalin liked to drink and he liked to smoke. Even as he entered his 70s, he would host drunken parties that lasted until 5 in the morning, fully expecting his subordinates to be available should he decide to ring them in the middle of the night. As his health naturally deteriorated towards the end of his life, this was taken as proof that, obviously, the medical community was conspiring to kill him. Just as the wreckers had caused the health of the Soviet economy to falter, so it made perfect sense that Stalin's health was being wrecked by the top experts in the field. After all, he had finally quit smoking after 50 years. Stalin's doctor was obviously the best that the Kremlin had to offer, but when he advised total rest, Stalin repeatedly screamed for the man to be put in irons. He took it not as informed medical opinion, but as an attempt to remove him from power. Stalin vividly remembered Lenin getting the same advice after his first stroke, and he knew better than anyone what had happened after that. Stalin had reason to be suspicious. It is a certainty that members of the medical profession had acted passively or tacitly as his personal murderers on more than one occasion. The most notorious possibility was Lenin's widow, Nadezhda Krupskaya, who as education leader in Russia had argued that children must learn about factories and mines and farms and how to increase production. Stalin had never forgiven her for siding with Kamenev and Zinoviev after Lenin died, and as the years passed, her relationship with Lenin had been publicly downgraded to friend, companion, and finally assistant. She died the day after her 70th birthday celebration in 1939 at the height of the Great Terror, and there was no shortage of suspicion that her death had not been due to natural causes. Dr. Myra Nvovsi was designated as having been one of the central figures in a Jewish-guided doctor's plot to murder Stalin and overthrow the USSR for the sake of some foreign nation, which shifted from the United States to Britain to Israel. A few years and a few miles from Auschwitz, the same wheels were turning again. As Vovsi's prison interrogator told him, "We can't let our enemies misbehave. You will be punished. We'll get rid of you and your filthy race. Hitler was our enemy, but he was right about the Jews, that they are vermin who must be destroyed. We'll bury you and your filthy race 10 meters deep. We will never let our corn grow too high. We cut it at the right time." A cadre of doctors was arrested, and Stalin explicitly demanded they be tortured. He insisted that the interrogators throw the doctors into chains, beat them to a pulp, and grind them into powder. Once again, virtually all of them confessed to whatever was asked of them. The Soviet press began to increase references to rootless cosmopolitans and other universally understood euphemisms for Jews that had been popularized by the Third Reich. Commissions were set up for the purposes of removing Jews from medical facilities. Jewish medical school graduates began to be assigned to the Far East to practice. Open letters were written for publication in Pravda, cleverly demanding that Jews be sent to the Far East in order to protect them because Soviet people are naturally outraged by the ever-widening circle of treason and treachery and the fact that, to our sorrow, many Jews have helped our enemies to form a fifth column in our midst. Simple, misguided citizens may be driven to striking back indiscriminately against Jews. In Stalin's native Georgia, government agents brought dynamite to blow up synagogues. They chose to bide their time until the defiant Jews were deported rather than face resistance. The message was heard loud and clear throughout the communist nations. Mao's doctor in China was a Soviet Jew. Agents were sent to arrest the man for supposedly trying to poison him. The president of Jewish advocacy organization B'nai B'rith met with U.S. State Department officials and told them flatly that he believed that the Soviets have decided on a campaign of extermination. After all, the Soviet Union already had a functioning concentration camp system with an enormously high casualty rate. It seemed as if the Jews would need a miracle to stop the worst from happening again, and they got one. It is not clear who precisely discovered Stalin on March 1st, 1953. After neither his household staff nor his subordinates heard from him all day, a brave soul finally dared to enter his chambers to check in on him. Whoever it was found him on the floor, immobile but alive, in a pool of his own urine. Now the staff were in a dilemma about what to do. Nothing of import could be done in the Soviet Union without Stalin's approval, yet Stalin was clearly unable to grant it. Beria was informed, and then he got on the phone, but that only put the sword of Damocles over his head. He knew perfectly well what had happened to his predecessors, Yezhov and Yagoda. If it looked as if he were plotting against Stalin, he could be killed. If it looked as if he was conspiring with the doctors who had supposedly been plotting against Stalin, he could be killed. After much hand-wringing, the decision was made the following morning to ask the Minister of Health to get help. There was one major problem. The best doctors in the country would have been the ones assigned to Stalin and other top Soviet officials, and those were the men who Stalin had accused of plotting against him. In what can be seen as either the height of irony or the epitome of farce, though probably both, the doctors who were being held in government torture chambers at that moment began to be questioned for medical advice. "What specialist would you recommend for one of our most important people who had just had a stroke?" one was asked. Unbeknownst to him, all 8 of the specialists he recommended were also imprisoned. The captors had still more questions. Despite his confusion, the physician nevertheless did his best to explain what a Cheyne Stokes respiration was. He was unaware that that had been the tentative diagnosis reached by the clueless doctors who had been sent to attend to the dying Stalin. Men so incompetent, they couldn't even figure out how to operate the artificial respirator. Stalin's doctor Svetlana was there to see the end. As her biographer Rosemary Sullivan described it, Stalin's death throes were agonizing. For several days, he lay unconscious, choking on his own fluids as a cerebral hemorrhage spread throughout his brain. His face gradually darkened, his lips turned black. He was being slowly strangled. Stalin also began vomiting blood at one point. At what seemed like the very last moment, he suddenly opened his eyes and cast a glance over everyone in the room, Svetlana remembered. Then something incomprehensible and awesome happened that to this day I can't forget and don't understand. He suddenly lifted his left hand as though he were pointing to something above and bringing down a curse on us all. And with that, Stalin perished. It only took days after his death for the edifice that Stalin had built to start being undone, strongly suggesting that Soviet leaders really had been conspiring behind his back to plan a post-Stalin USSR. The Gulag system quietly began to be dissembled, and a broad amnesty was declared, liberating minors, mothers with young children, and those serving terms of fewer than 5 years. Nearly 1 million total inmates were soon released, a mix of political prisoners and criminals in a nation where the line between the two was often blurred. Publicly, the government began to acknowledge not just mistakes, but brazen wrongdoing. The Internal Affairs Ministry released a statement acknowledging that the doctors that had been arrested were arrested without any legal basis and admitting that they had been tortured into professing their guilt, a government confession without precedent in Soviet history. Pravda referred to the newly freed medical professionals as honest and esteemed figures of our state, while also doing a complete reversal on one demonized Jewish writer, now rehabilitating him as that people's artist of the USSR who has been shamelessly slandered. But as one crisis ended, another began, for it seemed apparent that Beria would be the one to take over for Stalin. Far less paranoid than Stalin had been, Beria nevertheless would have no issue dispatching those who got in his way. Worse, his sadism was well known throughout Kremlin circles. To have escaped Stalin's reign unscathed was no easy task. Now, Soviet leaders found themselves in a position where they might have to live in perpetual fear of what tortures Beria would visit upon them and their families. It took fewer than 4 months after Stalin's death for Beria to be arrested. He was accused of a slew of crimes at a December 1935 trial and executed immediately thereafter. It was a conclusion he knew all too well, for it was a fate that he himself had doled out to many thousands upon thousands of innocents. In his place, the comparatively unknown Nikita Khrushchev took on the role as the new leader of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev was no saint. He too had a fair amount of blood on his hands from when he had been party leader for Moscow, taking part in Stalin's purges. How much guilt can be ascribed to him personally is a matter of debate, for the circumstances very clearly had been kill or be killed. Of all the people who Stalin had feared would betray him, it was Khrushchev who turned out to be the one that Stalin should have been most worried about. After midnight on February 25th, 1956, Khrushchev delivered a speech entitled On the Cult of Personality and Its Consequences to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. It was a 4-hour talk delivered behind closed doors with no journalists or foreigners permitted to attend. Due to the unusual circumstances under which the talk was presented, it popularized popularly became known as the secret speech. 3 years after Stalin's death, Khrushchev turned his back not just on Stalin, but on the very idea of Stalinism itself and from the same rostrum that Stalin had recently occupied. Khrushchev opened by pointing out that it is impermissible and foreign to the spirit of Marxism-Leninism to elevate one person to transform him into a superman possessing supernatural characteristics akin to those of a god. Such a man supposedly knows everything, sees everything, thinks for everyone, can do anything, is infallible in his behavior. Khrushchev immediately went on to make clear that he was talking specifically about Stalin before denouncing his absolutely insufferable character. Khrushchev acknowledged that whoever opposed Stalin was doomed to removal from the leading collective and to subsequent moral and physical annihilation, and that Stalin's confessions were acquired through physical pressures against the accused. As a result, honest communists were slandered, accusations against them were fabricated, and revolutionary legality was gravely undermined. Enemies, who were actually never enemies, spies, wreckers, etc., but were always honest communists, they were only so stigmatized, and often no longer able to bear barbaric tortures, they charged themselves with all kinds of grave and unlikely crimes. As plain as day, the man who replaced Stalin condemned his murders and torture. And how is it possible that a person confesses to crimes which he has not committed? Only in one way, because of application of physical methods of pressuring him, tortures, bringing him to a state of unconsciousness, deprivation of his judgment, taking away of his human dignity. In this manner were confessions acquired. Khrushchev did not even denounce bloodshed per se, but argued that it was only to be used in a specific context. It was a bit of historical revisionism that became known as the good Lenin, bad Stalin thesis. Lenin used such methods, however, only against actual class enemies and not against those who blunder, who err, and whom it was possible to lead through ideological influence and even retain in the leadership. Lenin used severe methods only in the most necessary cases when the exploiting classes were still in existence and were vigorously opposing the revolution, when the struggle for survival was decidedly assuming the sharpest forms, even including a civil war. But as ex-communist James Burnham pointed out, the good Lenin, bad Stalin thesis was just more propaganda. It should not be supposed that the terror with which communism is linked is a transient phenomenon, a temporary device used and perhaps abused for some special emergency of the revolution. Terror has always been an essential part of communism from the pre-revolutionary days when Stalin, as Koba, was directing the bombings whereby Bolshevik funds were assembled, through the years before 1917 when Lenin was approving the private tortures administered to political dissidents, into every stage of the development of the communist regime in power. Terror is proved by historical experience to be integral to communism, to be in fact, the main instrument by which its power is increased and sustained. From the beginning of the communist regime in Russia, every major political and economic turn has been carried through by terror. Khrushchev then gave credence to the conspiracy theory that the murder of Kirov was neither the act of a lone gunman nor of those who ended up paying the price for the assassination, but of Stalin himself. He pointed out how the agent assigned to protect Kirov was killed in a car accident in which no other occupants of the car were harmed, and how top NKVD officials were executed in 1937. We can assume that they were shot in order to cover the traces of the organizers of Kirov's killing. He went on to question the very basis of the Great Terror. The mass repressions at this time were made under the slogan of a fight against the Trotskyites. Did the Trotskyites at this time actually constitute such a danger to our party and to the Soviet state? Khrushchev went on to answer the question with a firm no. Trotskyism was completely disarmed. Stalin put the party and the NKVD up to the use of mass terror when the exploiting classes had been liquidated in our country and where there were no serious reasons for the use of extraordinary mass terror. Not content to condemn Stalin's crimes internally, he continued to savage him for what happened in the prelude to the Soviet Union entering World War II. When we look at many of our novels, films, and historical scientific studies, said Khrushchev, the role of Stalin in the Patriotic War appears to be entirely improbable. Stalin had foreseen everything. In fact, it was Churchill himself who personally warned Stalin that the Germans had been regrouping their armed units with the intent of attacking the Soviet Union. Khrushchev bluntly regarded the domestic Russian propaganda as nonsense. During the war and after the war, Stalin put forward the thesis that the tragedy which our nation experienced in the first part of the war was the result of the unexpected attack of the Germans against the Soviet Union. But comrades, this is completely untrue. As soon as Hitler came to power in Germany, he assigned himself the task of liquidating communism. The fascists were saying this openly. They did not hide their plans. When the fascist armies had actually invaded Soviet territory and military operations began, Moscow issued the order that the German fire was not to be returned. Why? It was because Stalin, despite evident facts, thought that the war had not yet started, that this was only a provocative action on the part of several undisciplined sections of the German army, and that our reaction might serve as a reason for the Germans to begin the war. And what was the result of this? The worst that we had expected. The Germans surrounded our army concentrations, and consequently, we lost hundreds of thousands of our soldiers. This is Stalin's military genius. This is what it cost us. All the more shameful was the fact that after our great victory over the enemy, which cost us so much, Stalin began to downgrade many of the commanders who contributed so much to the victory over the enemy, because Stalin excluded every possibility that services rendered at the front should be credited to anyone but himself. Khrushchev went on to confirm the mass deportation of entire peoples within the Soviet Union, grimly joking that the Ukrainians avoided meeting this fate only because there were too many of them and there was no place to which to deport them. Otherwise, he would have deported them also. Claims which had been made with a straight face under Stalin were now met with laughter, for they were and always had been farcical. Could it be possible that nationalist tendencies grew so much that there was a danger of Georgias leaving the Soviet Union and joining Turkey? Yet this was the accusation under which thousands of alleged Georgian separatists had been killed or exiled. As for the doctor's plot, we found it to be fabricated from beginning to end. Trotsky was incorrect. The party was not, in fact, always right, as the party's main spokesperson made clear over the course of 4 hours. The twist to the whole saga was that the ultimate wrecker was none other than Stalin himself. The way forward was clear. It is necessary for this purpose, Khrushchev concluded, to condemn and to eradicate the cult of the individual alien to Marxism-Leninism and not consonant with the principles of party leadership and the norms of party life, and to fight inexorably all attempts at bringing back this practice in one form or another. For many communists around the world, reading the transcript of Khrushchev's speech was the end of the line. They had been content for years to dismiss criticism of the Soviet Union in general, and of Stalin in particular, as capitalist propaganda. Though there were some vague attempts to pretend that reports of Khrushchev's speech were all forgery or the like, few took such claims to heart. In America and other liberal democracy, party members handed in their cards and quit. It turned out that the criticism had been true, all of it. The Soviet Union was no workers' paradise at all, but a workers' slaughterhouse. The words of Mikhail Bakunin, Marx's foremost rival, came to mind. When the people are being beaten with a stick, they are not much happier if it is called the people's stick. Throughout the Eastern Bloc, a process of de-Stalinization began. Two exceptions to this were China and North Korea, creating a rift between East and West that never fully healed. But in the other communist nations, Stalin's veneration began to be reversed. The Russian city of Stalingrad had been renamed in his honor in 1925. Khrushchev reverted it to Volgograd. In Prague, there stood a giant 50-foot-tall statue of Stalin leading a group of workers, one that took over 5 years to build. It was dynamited into nothing. Statue after statue, honor after honor, monument after monument, all began to fall. Yet the biggest, most famous communist monument was yet to come, and not in the Soviet Union either. That honor would be visited upon the people of Germany, specifically the citizens of Berlin. Chapter 10. A country where human life is nothing. It would have been considered unthinkable for the simple reason that no one would ever have a reason to think it. How do you divide a city in half? Though city life has many disadvantages, the advantages of cities are plentiful. Cities are centers of art and culture, breeding grounds for new ideas. Cities are centralized locations to do business, which means jobs. Cities are dense, with art and culture and business in somewhat close proximity to one another. The more urbanized the city tends to be, the more tightly packed it ends up being. It takes decades for cities to grow into an integrated whole, streets feeding into streets, neighborhoods developing their own character. Integration is both a natural and a man-made trend for cities. After World War II, Germany was divided by the Allies into four occupation zones: Soviet, French, American, and British. The German capital, Berlin, located entirely within the Eastern Soviet zone, was itself split into four. Though Germany was still largely in ruins, local elections were still held in the Soviet zone in the fall of 1946. Persisting in the narrative that Soviet totalitarianism was completely the opposite of fascist totalitarianism, by every important metric, the German communists tried to win control through democratic processes. Despite Soviet efforts, the Social Democrats were the clear victors with 49% of the vote in a three-way race. Worse, the center-right Christian Democratic Union came in second. The Communist Party was a distant third with 20% of the vote. In no district did they come in first, not even the ones where they had had majority support before Hitler's reign. The Russians were in a bind and took appropriate measures. That winter, they began mass arrests of supposed Nazis and subversives. In practice, this simply meant anyone opposed to domination from Moscow, no matter where they happened to land on the political spectrum. Then came the People's Police, a further hardening of authoritarianism under the USSR's control. Finally, the Soviets reopened the camps. Buchenwald, rechristened NKVD Special Camp No. 2, was near the city of Weimar, and Sachsenhausen, No. 7, a mere 35 kilometers from Berlin. Close to 200,000 people rounded up and carted away when the world was still reeling from seeing the images of the Holocaust. Years later, over 10,000 bodies would be uncovered at Sachsenhausen alone, the majority of whom were minors and the elderly. How to handle Germany was an enormously difficult question, even just among the Western countries. The Western nations intended to reinvigorate Germany as a country partial to them. This, of course, had not sat well with Stalin, but the Russians were outnumbered 3-1 by the Americans, the British, and the French in terms of control. Stalin withdrew from the Allied Control Council when he discovered that a plan was drawn up by the Western powers to squeeze out Soviet influence. That June came the introduction of a new Deutschmark via the British and the Americans.